Our next oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Veith. Thank you. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. As I'm sure everyone's been advised, both under the Minnesota Rules of Public Access and 4D, and our own Minnesota Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure, since we're dealing with a redacted brief, this precludes mention in open court of records that have been sealed by the district court order, which occurred in this case. And in addition, all parties should take reasonable steps to prevent the disclosure of that confidential information at oral argument. I have instructed the marshal if inadvertently any one of us or any one of you discusses that, that will be redacted from the audio recording. I think we all are aware of the information that this defense believes should have been admitted at trial. So I think you can just proceed that we know that and go right ahead. Thank you very much, counsel. You may begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Suzanne Senecal-Hill, and I'm an assistant state public defender representing appellant Annette Veith. In every case, the jury, acting as fact finder, is tasked with deciding where the truth lies. The truth the jury in this case was tasked to decide was whether Ms. Veith, who for years was a loving mother to her adopted children, sexually assaulted her adopted son, or whether it's possible that her adopted son sexually assaulted her. It's a really, really difficult concept for a person to wrap their head around the idea that a young 14-year-old kid would sexually assault his mom, and that's the reason why the challenged evidence in this case is so crucial. What the district court did was to rule that the evidence was inadmissible because it was precluded by the rape shield law. But other than Ms. Veith's argument about fabrication, the district court never addressed whether the challenged evidence was necessary to honor Ms. Veith's constitutional right to present a complete defense. And really, the district court was wrong. The challenged evidence isn't precluded by the rape shield statute, but even if this court concludes otherwise, the evidence was relevant and material to Ms. Veith's defense, and therefore she was entitled to have the jury hear that information.
Can I take you to your constitutional argument?
Sure.
There's this weighing of prejudice versus probative value that the district court undertakes. What is your understanding of our standard of review as to that weighing, whether there's a substantial outweighing prejudice versus probative?
Are you asking me whether it's a straight 403 analysis?
I'm asking you on our review, to what extent do we defer to the district court? Is this a matter of the district court's discretion in weighing the substantial nature or the insubstantial nature of the balance?
I think the overarching standard of review is abuse of discretion, but I think this court can evaluate on its own what is the probative value and is there unfair prejudice.
Wait a minute. That's what I'm lost about. So what is the probative value and whether there's unfair prejudice? Aren't those matters of discretion in the district court? The district court's hearing the evidence. The district court has an opportunity to get a sense of how weighty is the probative value of this possible evidence, disputed evidence. How significant is the prejudice? Aren't those matters of some deference because of the district court's unique situation?
I would agree that there could be some deference, but that doesn't mean that this court is without authority to overrule it if the district court was abusing its discretion.
No, I understand that. I just wanted to be clear. You haven't found any case law that suggests any other standard than abuse of discretion on those questions.
No, Your Honor, I haven't.
Can you tell me what is the prejudice that we're considering? Prejudice to whom in this case? Are we considering prejudice to the witness as to embarrassment or whatever from the revelation of this evidence, or is it prejudice to the state in the possibility that the evidence might be misapplied by the jury?
I believe that it's the latter. It's the prejudice to the state, to the state's case, because that whole analysis overall, I don't see that there's a niche carved out for rape shield issues. It seems to be, in reading the case law, that it's just a straight 403 analysis. So in that sense, it's what is the probative value, and is that probative value substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice?
And one other question on the big picture elements. When we ask what is the probative value, it's not in the vacuum in this case, is it? It's the what is the probative value of this non-admitted evidence over the probative weight of the evidence that's already been admitted or that was admissible?
Okay, I'm trying to understand that. So you're asking if it's the
hard to ask the question with so many confidential issues in this case. Let me ask it this way. So the jury was aware that you had this point counterpoint. I accuse him of raping me, and then later, while incarcerated for that, soon after the accusation, he then, after some time, accuses her. The jury is aware of that, and it becomes a central focus of the closing argument and the whole case. Am I correct about that?
I think broadly, yes. But obviously, my position is that there were key.
Can you say broadly, specifically? Right? Well, I think the jury was aware that she had accused her son of raping her.
Yes.
And that he then later accused her of raping him. The jury was aware of that.
Yes.
So on the question of its probative value, this is my original question was going to this point. So the jury or the defense is already armed with the opportunity to impeach based upon the idea that you made your accusation only out of fear of being found to be the culprit. You accused her only after she accused you so that you can avoid the criminal penalty for raping your mother. The defendant was already armed with that.
Yes, with that particular argument, yes.
So I'm trying to get a sense of, without talking about anything that's confidential here, it's hard for me to ask these questions.
Right, it's hard to answer them.
How much greater, I mean, incrementally, would there have been in this, the argument as to the, well, because we now know the nature of the potential probation violation, that therefore there's this exceptional extra probative value. I'm trying to get a sense of how there was any real extra probative value.
There's extra probative value because the jury did hear that information, but the jury is left with the impression that originally the state believed the son. And then later the son says a couple of things, says that my mom is actually the one who initiated the sexual intercourse. And so then the state drops the charges against the son and initiates charges against Ms. Veith. That leaves the jury with the impression that the state believes the son over Ms. Veith. So when you ask about probative value, you need not look any further than this court's decision in Crims, where the idea is what is the relevancy and what is the need.
Right, but if I can see how, if I'm a defense lawyer in this case, I want the jury to have this information, but I'm trying to get a sense if you're the state, the reason a defense might want this and the reason that the state might not want it, in fact, wants to oppose it, is this issue of prejudice, which is the potential for the jury to rely upon the evidence for the as character, to show propensity, which it, and I don't see much other use beyond that.
Well, I think this court can be guided by the line of cases stemming from Wormeskirchen, where you flip the script, where it's the defendant who's asking for this type of evidence to be left out, and what the appellate, and we as defendants continually challenge that, and what the appellate courts have said time and time again is that that's not character evidence, it's not propensity evidence, it is evidence that is relevant to a key factual issue, and one of those key factual issues is who sexually assaulted whom.
Right, in those cases, I haven't seen any other case like this one, where it's set in this situation, where you have an accusation that's met with a counter-accusation later on. That seems to distinguish those. I could see how the argument would have great weight if you didn't have that scenario, if all you had was the probation potential, the potential for probation violation, but you didn't have this point counterpoint as to who raped whom.
But I think that is the essential issue in the entire case, and if the defense cannot explain to the jury why a 14-year-old kid would rape his mother, the jury is hamstrung. There's a whole motive issue that the state routinely gets to present evidence in cases, and this court has said that that's relevant evidence. I think it's not enough to sanitize what happened. The jury needed to know the specifics, because if you look at Crims, what Crims says is it's relevant if it's clearly similar behavior. And again, trying to protect the confidentiality of the information, I would direct this court to the contested omnibus hearing exhibit number 10, which talks about what the prior criminal sexual assault was, as well as defense counsel's offer of proof. If you look at what is alleged, Ms. Veith is alleged happened to her by her son, you're talking about multiple incidents of sexual assault. Despite her protests, no. You're talking about potential physical intimidation, psychological intimidation. This is a sexual assault of a family member. If you compare that to exhibit number 10 and the state's offer of proof, you see a clearly similar pattern of behavior. It simply isn't enough to say this kid had some bad behavior and there was an initial allegation that he sexually assaulted mom. The jury needs to understand why Ms. Veith would be saying that. That's her whole defense of why she would say her son sexually assaulted her. And if you can't get into the motive, and if you can't show tell the jury why there's this clearly similar pattern of behavior, then of course there's no way to counter what the state has set up, which is we dismiss these charges against the son because we don't believe that happened, and we're pursuing charges against Ms. Veith. And I'm not sure how else to articulate how incredibly crucial that is to the defense. It's incredibly probative, and in terms of the danger for unfair prejudice, this court and appellate courts time and time again have said that unfair prejudice isn't damaging evidence. It's not severely damaging evidence. It's evidence that persuades by illegitimate means. And when I'm on the other side arguing that information like this persuades by illegitimate means, I'm met time and time again with no. It may be damaging. It may be severely damaging. But
well, none of the cases you cite have this, what I think is unique in this case, as I've already mentioned, the cross allegations of rape between the victim and the defendant. And if you could, I would be more convinced of your argument if there was such a case, regardless of whether it's the defense or the state that is opposing the introduction of this evidence.
Well, I think this is the case. Unfortunately, sometimes there just isn't. And
no, but I mean, you pointed out the fact that, well, when you're on the other side, you're met with such and such. But I don't know that this is
but
an apples-to-apples case.
It kind of is, because the whole point of a trial is to get to the truth. So if a defendant cannot provide the jury with relevant and probative information that supports his or her theory of the defense, then the jury isn't given the information that it truly needs to decide the truth. And I think
the theory I think that you're arguing for is that the jury needs to know that the victim in this case faced a significant punishment if he's found to have done what he's accused of?
That is one point, but not the entire point.
That's the most significant point, isn't it?
No, not in my mind. The most significant point is to provide the jury with an explanation as to why a 14-year-old kid would sexually assault his mom. It is a novel concept. It's a taboo concept.
I don't understand how the evidence that you're suggesting would help the jury to understand why a 14-year-old kid would sexually abuse his mom, other than propensity. It sounds like propensity evidence that you're talking about, character evidence. I don't understand the logical connection between
sure.
the proposition you say the evidence should be used for.
And again, on the flip side, that is something that we deal with quite a bit. But I again urge this court to look at Wormerskirchen, which says evidence like this, where it's prior sexual conduct, misconduct, isn't character evidence. It isn't propensity evidence. It's relevant evidence that goes to a key factual issue in the case. And so the key factual issue, one of the key factual issues in this case was how is this possible that a 14-year-old kid would do this to his mom? And so if you have relevant evidence that, and I again, I apologize, because one of the other pieces
I understand that. How is it possible that he would do this to his mom? I don't understand the relationship between the evidence that you say should have been admitted and that argument. I don't know, understand how that argument would be presented to a district, to
because
the, to
it's
the jury.
A pattern of similar conduct under Crims.
It's propensity.
No, not under Wormerskirchen, it's not. Wormerskirchen says, and all the cases after that say, it's admissible to show the actor did what was alleged. It is admissible to be, and it's directly relevant to a key factual issue of who assaulted whom. That is directly from Wormerskirchen, and that's what appellate courts rely on Wormerskirchen all the time for this particular issue. It is splitting of the hairs, but it's a distinction that appellate courts have made. In this case, we're looking at a pattern of similar conduct. That pattern of similar conduct is relevant and material to explain why a 14-year-old kid would sexually assault his mom. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Senecal Hill. You will have rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Excuse me. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Plant. I'm here on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I'm acting on behalf of the county of Winona today because this was a conflict case, as I'm sure you're aware from the record. And I'm here today to ask that the court affirm the district court and find that the judge acted well within her discretion when she excluded the evidence that's at issue here. I'd like to start out by addressing a couple of counsel's points with respect to the Crims, and note that the point is not that this evidence is relevant. The policy behind what is referred to commonly as the Rape Shield Law is that this is irrelevant evidence. Sexual conduct with a third party is generally classified under the case law in Minnesota as being irrelevant and therefore presumptively excluded unless one can show a clearly similar pattern of behavior. And I emphasize the word clearly here, which counsel used once but omitted the second time when talking about this standard, because what we have here, without discussing the facts, is two very unclearly and dissimilar acts, not to mention I would argue that two incidents don't actually constitute a pattern, but more importantly, these were not incidents of conduct that were clearly similar. To refresh the court's recollection with respect to the State v. Crims case, the word clearly in that case meant that exchanging sex for drugs was not clearly similar to exchanging sex for drug money. That's how fine of a point the court was putting on the distinction of what clearly similar is versus just generally speaking similar. And they used that analysis to underscore the importance of this policy that third-party sexual conduct, when we're talking about a victim in a criminal sexual conduct prosecution, is irrelevant unless it meets one of the statutory or rule-based exceptions, which it does not here, nor has it been suggested that it does, nor do we have a clearly similar pattern of conduct.
I understand that argument as to the rule, but the idea that this is irrelevant from a defense standpoint seems to me a difficult argument for the state to make, that there is a basis for the for the fabrication of the accusation in this case, and therefore this other conduct could support the basis for the fabrication.
Correct. And I would say that that gets you beyond the first step of the presumption that this is, generally speaking, considered irrelevant. However, as the proponent of the evidence, she would be required to demonstrate that there's sufficient clearly similar conduct or sufficient evidence of fabrication to get this beyond and over that presumption of irrelevance. And in this particular case, we also still have to, even though she's entitled to provide her complete defense, it's not relevant to the extent that it outweighs the unnecessary risk of prejudice both to the state and the victim,
outweighs,
I would argue.
Substantially outweighs.
Substantially outweighs to the extent that in this case it's not particularly probative. There was significant evidence to support the defense theory of the case with respect to not only the recordings of the defendant's initial report, or excuse me, appellant's initial report to law enforcement, as well as the covert call she made with the victim that was also recorded and played for the jury. But the victim's uncle testified, the defendant's husband testified, the therapist testified, the eldest sister in the family testified, and the record was replete, to use the words from my brief, with information that was consistent with the defendant's theory of the case, which was that we had a victim who was intimidating, not just specifically to the sexual assaults that were charged out, but also in general, both to his mother and to other people in the family. So to the extent that there was probative value, it was de minimis because we already had extensive testimony as well as other evidence, such as the recording.
Intimidating is sort of different from having a real, genuine motive to fabricate things. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree.
And and let's say this was a burglary and the felony was a prior burglary, and the alleged victim is on probation for burglary. And to then accuse the defendant, I didn't rob her, she robbed me. Being on probation for a burglary offense would be a pretty significant motive to fabricate as to who's really, being burgled. And isn't, and Ms. Senecal Hill can make the arguments, but assuming that's really why defense counsel wanted this in, what's your best argument that, nope, still doesn't come in? We're not talking now propensity, because I think I agree with Judge Ross. It seems to me, if that's why this is trying to get in, that's not right. That's impermissible. And I think Ms. Senecal Hill's did a good job of explaining to us why that's not that. But really, isn't that the essential thing under her right to the defendant's right to complete a complete defense? That's really an unbelievably powerful motive to fabricate, which the jury should have been aware of, as opposed to sort of, these vague things. What's your response to that? Because for me, I think that's the heart of the case as to why we should consider reversing this conviction.
Well, there are a couple of questions in there, Judge. First of all, there is a distinction between your hypothetical question or case of the burglar, to the extent that there's not a specific burglar shield law where we look at whether we're going to protect defendants from information about prior crimes that are similar in modus operandi.
But clearly, the constitutional right to provide a complete defense would arguably even trump the rape shield law, would it not?
Well, that's what CRIM speaks to, exactly that point. And they construe the statute to be, and actually use the words, that the statute is in harmony with the constitutional right to present a complete defense. And there's no right to have admitted evidence that is unduly prejudicial, that has relatively minimal probative value, which, again, is what we have here. Now, with respect to what you've called was, I think, a extremely high or strong motive for fabrication. Let's not forget that we have a victim here who was extremely forthcoming on the stand about what occurred. He never said there was no sex. He never said, I never tore a phone out of my hand, or I never postured my mother's hand, or I never postured with her, or no, I was never intimidating. This was a young man who was unequivocal about what happened, not who did what to whom, but specifically the conduct that occurred. And so ultimately what it came down to, of course, was a credibility determination of who's more credible. The defendant, or beyond a reasonable doubt, I should say, did the state prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt is really what it came down to. But at the end, the jury heard all of this evidence that was consistent with the defendant's theory of the case. They heard Victor Veith testify that the victim was a master manipulator. They heard plenty of evidence, including from state's witnesses, that the victim had a past of intimidating behavior, which I should note was the defense's primary contention, both in her brief here on appeal as well as in the trial court. The primary contention that was that this was probative and relevant evidence, not because of the conduct that occurred, but because the method that the victim supposedly used to accomplish that conduct, both in the sealed information or records as well as the information here. She did not focus on the similarity of the conduct. It was the similarity of the modus operandi, if you will, of using intimidation to accomplish that conduct. So that argument was not raised at trial, and arguably it wasn't really raised in the brief here. The whole argument was, well, gee, he was intimidating, and that's how he got what he wanted. That's not arguing that he was motivated by an intense desire to fabricate what really went on. And the jury did, at the end of the day, decide that all of the evidence was proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defense's story just didn't fly. They didn't find it consistent, even after hearing the recordings of the appellant saying, this is what happened. I accuse him. And we also heard the therapist, as I noted, who provided, with respect to the error, because ultimately, getting back to Judge Ross's point earlier, we are looking at a deferential standard. This is an abusive discretion standard. I would, and I do, assert that the district court did not abuse her discretion and acted well within it. But beyond that, even if there was an error, it's still the appellant's burden to demonstrate that there was some sort of error. There was no error here that harmed the defendant beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard with respect to whether or not she's entitled to a new trial. The answer is no, for the same reasons I just described. The state's witnesses testified that, yes, this was a young man who was on probation. This is a young man whose probation officer testified at the trial and said, yes, he was on probation. Everyone in the courtroom knew that this victim was on probation and had a powerful motivation to fabricate events to avoid further punishment. He didn't. He sat on the witness stand. He acknowledged what happened. This was not probative evidence, and it certainly wasn't evidence that could overcome the balancing test with respect to whether it was unduly prejudicial in light of all the other evidence consistent with the defendant's case, which made it cumulative.
Can you comment on the questions that I raised with Ms. Seneca Hill on the where we measure the probative value of the excluded evidence from, whether it's in a vacuum or the extent to which it is probative beyond what is already admitted into evidence, which in this case is the victim has a motive to fabricate because he's been accused of rape himself.
No, I don't think you look at it in a vacuum. I think all the cases dictate that one must look at it in the context of all of the other evidence, which is why we look at it whether or not it should be excluded based on the fact that it's cumulative. And again, looking at this young man, what his motivation was, if the idea that the court's questions are stemming from is that being on probation gives one a powerful motivation to lie or fabricate about not having engaged in further criminal conduct. Again, the record is replete with information about that. The probation officer testified about the fact that he was on probation. Ms. Veith's reports and recordings that were admitted into evidence said there are alarms. There are trip alarms on the door. There are special locks that have been installed so that someone can exit the room, but no one can enter it. There were motion sensor detectors around the room. And then, of course, we also have the evidence in the record. Let's not forget that the probation officer said, no, I didn't know the alarm had been disabled. The therapist said, no, I didn't know the alarm had been disabled. That was part of the safety plan. I would have done something had I known that the alarm was disabled. The probation officer also said, no, I didn't know that was disabled, and I would have done something if I had known that. The probation officer didn't even know that the victim had what the prosecutor referred to as a smartphone, so that essentially he was enabled to have unbridled access to the internet if he so desired. So with respect, just to turn to a moment back to the idea that this was an, if there was an error, which I don't believe there was, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because there was significant and substantial evidence to support the state's theory of the case and to convict Ms. Veith beyond a reasonable doubt, as was done in this case. Notwithstanding that, I still believe, and this is where the district court ruled, that this would have been cumulative evidence had it been admitted to the defendant's theory of the case.
Was there a discussion, Ms. Pond, about the consequences of his probation if it had been revoked or he's on probation? Or did anyone explain?
No, there was testimony specific to that point. Ms. Sather stated, I think at least twice, that had she known of intimidating or physically aggressive behavior, she would have written up a hold or a warrant, essentially, to take the victim here into custody, at least put him on a hold and remove him from the home so that no one would be in danger. And the therapist essentially said the same thing. They called the services that the victim was receiving, I believe, WRAP services, WRAP, to the extent that the idea is that you're wrapping around this young man with services from different angles of the system so that he has what he needs to both keep him on the path towards rehabilitation as well as protect others while he's on that path. And so the therapist did state that he would have taken action had he thought there were any reason to be concerned.
But to Judge Connolly's question, I haven't looked at the record on this point, and I'm curious about it. I'm curious as to the extent to which the jury was aware of the nature of the penalty the victim would have faced for a probation violation. Was the jury aware that there could be prison time, treatment as an adult, or the other significant permanent effect?
My recollection is yes. I may be conflating the record from the contested omnibus hearing with the trial transcripts that I was reviewing prior to today. However, my recollection is that Mr. Sigersma specifically addressed that, again, the therapist, with respect to what the nature of the penalties would be were the victim to fail on probation. And Ms. Sather, the probation officer, Sather, S-A-T-H-E-R for the record, I elided that syllable, did also testify about the nature of the penalties that this young man would be facing. and the severity of the underlying conduct that the jury was not allowed to hear about. Again, to reemphasize that point, Annie Veith, the first witness out of the gate on behalf of the state, testified about the fact that there were special locks on the door, motion sensors in the house, trip alarms that were set up, and the idea that the victim was someone who at least society was worried about being a danger to others.
One more question. Whether or not the jury heard the evidence of what the potential penalty was for a probation violation without being informed of the nature of the basis for the sentence leading to the probation, is our question whether the jury heard the evidence, as we weigh probative value versus prejudice, is our question whether the jury actually heard the evidence of the significance of the penalty, or the nature of the penalty, or whether the defendant had the opportunity to present that evidence to the jury?
Yes, there was extensive cross-examination by Mr. Applebaum of all of the witnesses with respect.
No, my question is as a matter of our approach to balancing prejudice versus probativeness, is the question whether the jury actually heard evidence of what the victim might face for a probation violation, or whether the defendant had the opportunity to have presented an extensive record for the jury to see the significance of a probation violation?
The defendant's opportunity to present that evidence. I'm not an expert by any means on this particular rule of evidence, and I really honed in on the specific issues with respect to this case, but erring on the side of the defendant, which these line of cases suggest we should do, I believe it is that the defendant should have the opportunity to present that that evidence. However, the defendant did have that opportunity with respect to the presentation of the witnesses who offered a consistent theory of the defense that Ms. Veith herself was a proponent of. So with that, barring further questions, I'm well over my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blunt. Ms. Senecal-Hill, you'll have the last word.
Okay, lots to unpack. First, Judge Ross, you asked about whether the jury heard of the potential penalties that the son faced if he violated probation. The school counselor, I don't know how to pronounce his name, page 788 of the transcript, said that he might also go to jail for violating probation. Chris Sather, the probation officer, said if she was aware that there was any misbehavior or misconduct, he would be arrested and potentially placed in treatment facility. Sorry. So there was no discussion about severe consequences for things like criminal sexual conduct, where a person could be going to prison. But getting back to Crim.
Wait, I understand that there is no testimony, but
that was the question that you asked. What did the jury understand that the potential consequences would be to the son?
My question though goes not just to what the jury understood, but what the jury could have been presented with in cross-examination, say, of JV. I mean, the defendant could have cross-examined him on his awareness that he may go to prison for a very long time, or that he may face significant penalties. I mean, am I correct that it's the opportunity to present the defense, not whether the defense was presented, that we're weighing on appeal?
You know, I'm to be honest, I'm not really sure. I would think that a defense attorney could take a crack at that, at asking the son what the potential consequences were for him if he understood what they would be. But I just want to backpedal.
And that's the issue.
It's not the issue. That's not the issue. I want to backpedal for a minute because this court and opposing counsel seems to be focused on this idea of fabrication. That was one piece of it. But if you look at the September 28th, 2017 transcript, defense counsel doesn't just talk about fabrication. Defense talks about who the aggressor is, about the prior bad act and whether evidence and whether the prior act was part of a pattern. Also talks about that this evidence is relevant to explain why Ms. Veith would have delayed in reporting. It's not just fabrication. And to the extent that this court...
Well, presumably the aggressor issue would have been the evidence that presented that he was intimidating. I mean, it seems to me that goes to that issue, and so I'm not so sure that's a good one. prior bad act? I mean, that sounds like propensity.
But again, it's not. We have prior rules relating to prior bad acts and when those are admissible. And this court can look, you know, at Crims and Warmer Skirchen, which I realize I keep harping on. But the idea is that in Crims is that if you have evidence that is relevant, then in the event of a conflict, the tiebreaker goes to the defendant, who gets to present the evidence because the defendant has a constitutional right to present a complete defense. In terms of this pattern of behavior, this clear pattern of behavior, pardon me, that Crims talks about, it's not just one prior and then this case. Look at Exhibit 10 in the contested omnibus hearing. It's not just one act. It was multiple acts. It is one conviction, but there were multiple acts. That, and based on what the conduct was, who it was with, how many times it happened, the circumstances under which it happened, and comparing that with the case at bar, it is a clearly similar pattern. And under Crims, that makes it relevant. And because it's relevant, Crims says the balance goes to the defendant, who gets to present the defense. Now, there's the other caveat of it still has to be more probative, and the probative value can't be substantially outweighed by the risk of unfair prejudice. But again, I do not see a distinction between evaluating probative value versus prejudicial effect when you're talking about a defendant versus when you're talking about this type of evidence that we're talking about today. It is the same analysis. The analysis is there unfair prejudice? And that is persuading by illegitimate means. Arguing that there is relevant evidence that, to quote Warmer Skirchen once again, that goes to is directly relevant to a key factual issue of who assaulted whom, then that's not persuading the jury by illegitimate means. It's not propensity evidence. It's not character evidence. It is prior bad acts evidence that gets to come in. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Plunt. Ms. Senecal Hill. Thank you, Ms. Plunt. The matter is submitted. As our next case is an ITV at 11:45, we are in recess.